Hi, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for giving up your time on a beautiful Melbourne early summer evening to come in and hear about something completely different. We are here to discuss our subject of our third fresh, and I really do mean hot off the presses, La Trobe Asia Brief, which is on the subject of the Himalaya, which we titled Melting Opportunities. And joined by three of the five authors. And before introducing them, I should also acknowledge that we're here on the Wurundjeri people's land, and I acknowledge their elders past and present. To my left, we have Anwesha Dutta, one of the authors. Anwesha is a postdoctoral researcher from the, is it the Christian Michelsen Institute? In Bergen, Norway, which is stretching the geographical definition of the Himalaya, but you do have a bit of ice up there, I'm told. And Anwesha is a postdoctoral researcher currently working on a project on wildlife trade and biodiversity in East Africa. To my right, Alex Davis is a New Generation Network research fellow in politics at La Trobe University, and Alex has been a stalwart of events at La Trobe Asia, often writing and giving his time, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back. And then on Alex's right, we have Dr. Ruth Gamble, who is a David Myers Research Fellow at La Trobe University, and Ruth is also another stalwart contributor to La Trobe Asia. Really, without you, I don't think we'd be able to function at critical mass. And Ruth, among other things, looks at environmental and conservation issues, but is housed in the China, the Center for China Study of the Inland and the China Studies Research Center here at La Trobe University. There are two authors who are not present, but who I'll nonetheless shout out: Dr. Sonika Gupta from the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras, and La Trobe's Dr. Joel Roche, who has an inset here talking about linguistic minorities in the Himalayan region. So we have a multidisciplinary, genuinely multidisciplinary cluster, all with a common interface on the Himalaya. Which was discovered, I should say, almost by accident at La Trobe University, that we found out we had such a critical mass of scholars, probably unparalleled anywhere else in the Southern Hemisphere. Here at La Trobe Asia, it also is very much our philosophy to try and seed cross-disciplinary projects and cooperation. This is a great example of that, looking not only at the sort of familiar Asian studies lens on the issue, but also science, and as well as we have in the nature of the Himalaya being transboundary China scholars, India scholars, and those who look at smaller states. And indeed, the major function of the brief is just to break down the state model and look also at the smaller groups who have been marginalized and are among the most fragile, their fragility in a way mirroring the physical fragility of the Himalayan region. So enough from me. I will now turn it over to the experts who will talk you through in conversation with me a little bit about the brief, and then we'll allow time for you to ask questions afterwards. Maybe, Ruth, I can start with you. An easy question that probably doesn't have an easy answer. Can you just start us off with what is the Himalayan region? How would you define it?
How would I define it, or how would Anwesha define it? Because we've been having some discussions about that.
You lead us off.
So I've decided that I'm taking the ISIMOD, is the largest intergovernmental panel on mountain development, and they're based in Kathmandu, and I think they do a lot of good work with developing policies for development and for the study of the environment and societies of the Himalaya. And they talk about the Hindu Kush Himalaya, And it's not just the mountain band that people usually think of that is to the north of India and the south of the Tibetan Plateau, but also the Tibetan Plateau itself and the highlands of Myanmar and of northeastern India and southern Yunnan. Right, so basically the high bits. I think that this is actually quite valid because there's kind of a history of geography in the region where the idea of having it as a small band called the Himalaya or Himalaya was developed by British geographers, and I don't think, no offense, Ewan, that they should get to say what the Himalaya is, and that the people of the area have much more of a sense of the highlands, the lands of snow. So you get this words, different words in different languages. That like Himalaya means the abode or the area of snow, and in Tibetan they say Kangchen. So this is the places with snow on it, and then coming down into the foothills of those regions as well. Yeah.
So, would you disagree with any of that, Wisha?
No.
I included Myanmar now.
We'll take that as a comprehensive definition in that case.
We did come to an agreement on this topic right when we were finalising the very final draft of the brief.
Yeah.
So basically whether to include Myanmar as part of Himalaya or not, and then Isimod we see does include Myanmar as part of the... So then we thought, yeah.
There was also another debate to let you into the inside gossip on this, on whether it should be Himalaya, Himalayas, Himalaya, Himalayan region. We went through many iterations on this and we settled on the Himalaya, or the, you say tomato, I say tomato, etc.
Yeah.
We're settled at least on the print, it's the Himalaya. Alex, how are the Himalaya threatened?
Well, what the brief maps out is that the Himalaya are threatened in three different ways, and that these are all interrelated and they tend to feed off one another. So there's the sort of global threat of global warming, which we are all in some way responsible for, in that the Himalaya is warming at something near twice global averages, I think a scientific report found recently. And this means that the ice caps are threatened. This is further exacerbated due to some of the political issues. And I come from international relations, mostly studying Indian foreign policy for the bulk of my academic career. And this makes it particularly difficult to deal with some of the problems to do with the melting glaciers. So the fact that the Himalayan ice pack is militarized by India, China, Pakistan, makes it very difficult it makes it difficult for them to collaborate or work together to protect the ice pack. And the fact that there is suddenly something like a million troops who have taken to the Himalayan region, including places like ice packs on contested borders, that is contributing to the issues of the glacial melt as well, which I think Ruth will talk about more as we go deeper into the issues. And so aside from this political and environmental threat, there's also an ongoing cultural transformation that's been taking place. It's sort of accelerated in the last 20 years or so, but it's to do with cultural transformation. The state, like India, China and Pakistan, because of these contested borders, sending more and more troops and infrastructure and people, that's transforming local cultures. So that's something that you see in Tibet, but you also see it in some of India's Himalayan states, particularly Jammu and Kashmir, Ladakh, Arunachal Pradesh, Sikkim, these kinds of areas. And so what the brief maps out is that the Himalaya is threatened in these three interrelated ways, and then it tries to work out some ways in which maybe this can be mitigated in the short term and fixed and protected in the long term.
And Ruth, it is true that the Himalaya constitutes the third largest ice pack on the planet?
It's the third largest ice pack the two poles clearly are big ice packs, but outside of the polar regions, it's the biggest ice pack, and it's also the source of most of Asia's largest rivers, all the rivers running from Pakistan through Southeast Asia, Nepal, Myanmar, Southeast Asia and up into East Asia.
A question for all of you, but we'll start with you, Anwesha. What's at stake in the region and beyond, for that matter? Why does it matter and why should we care?
So, you know, as Ruth and Alex already pointed out, that this region is really ecologically fragile, and it's so important for us because the ice caps are there, and this, the rivers that flow down from there are very important, not just for the communities upstream, but also for the communities downstream, where millions of people depend on these rivers and these water bodies for their livelihoods. And what is at stake are not just, like, of course, these are the environmental stakes, but the culture as... the erosion of culture with rampant tourism and increase of tourism, that's also at stake. And the other thing is, you know, this there's this Siachen Glacier where India now has stationed thousands of troops there. And this is a glacier where before 1984, it was uninhabited and it is not supposed to be inhabited. And because of that, they don't know what to do with all the waste that is being created there. And this is mostly plastic and metal waste. And since 1984, 869 soldiers have actually died there. So when you go and put, you know, so demilitarization is something very important, but it cannot happen only if India says it or China says it, because these three countries have to come together. And there's like international politics is at stake, and there is environment at stake. And, you know, there is like, because if these caps continue to melt, then of course all the downstream people will, you know, there'll be instances of floods, there will be like, you know, massive livelihood issues.
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight what Anwesha was saying about you get this strange, well, not strange, interesting relationship between armies and tourism. So Nepal has less border issues, for example, but it's trying to figure out ways to deal with the impact of tourism in fragile environments. And so you get... some places where you just have the army, sometimes army and tourism go together, so people come to look at army sites, which are also on glaciers, and then it's kind of a combination. And the weird thing for me is it happens on both sides. So if you go into the Tibetan regions, there's people who've come up from the plains to stare at the glaciers and camp in places, and you go to the Indian side and there's people coming up on both sides, which is great. It's great that they want to come up and see the mountains, but there's no real protocols in place in order to manage the tourism as well as the army influx into the region.
Just aside from environmental issues, obviously they're central to everything that we're talking about. I find that looking at the Himalaya, you see issues that exist all over the world, but I find that they're particularly intense in this region. So some of the questions that the brief deals with that we're talking about today, how do we do development? How do we make people's lives better while also managing the environment in a time of global warming? And then what do we even mean by development? Do we mean these large infrastructure projects and GDP growth, or do we mean something else? How do large states deal with diversity? We're seeing those issues in Australia, in the US, all over the world, and we're seeing them in India, China, and the Himalaya particularly. How do we deal with the historical colonial legacies that structure politics in many parts of the world? These are some of the issues that we're seeing in the Himalaya, and I think they're the great issues of our age, and I find them particularly intense and interesting there. So I think that's one reason also why we should be interested.
Maybe the most obvious geopolitical fault line that people associate with the Himalaya, and indeed as is reflected in the war of 1962, is that's where there is a disputed border between China and India. So let's just focus on those two big states to start with. Maybe, Ruth, with your China hat on, I can come to you first. Then Alex and Anwesha, maybe you could say a few words about how it's framed from the Indian perspective. But Ruth, how does China approach the Himalaya? What's the distinctive characteristics of the PRC governmental or non-governmental approach?
There's no non-governmental approach. not anymore, anyway. Well, let's see. So there's a weird thing, though, too, because the area of the high altitude areas of China are restive ethnic areas which are under intensive control and surveillance. movement within them is restricted, and when people go through the region, you have to be very careful about what you say and do. So there's a kind of a strict police and military presence in the region, and a surveillance presence, as I said. At the same time, because China's done a really good job in a lot of ways of lifting so many people out of poverty, and we all know that that lifting people out of poverty is creating environmental stresses that they then have to balance. And one of the ways that they've chosen to develop the Tibetan Plateau is to concentrate on tourism. So you're getting massive tourism infrastructure across the plateau, and
domestic tourism.
Domestic tourism. They don't want anyone from outside China. Anyway, domestic tourism. So it's a specific type of tourism. It's a tourism very much focused on scenic spots. So there's a whole network of scenic spots where you stop and take a photograph. All across the area, and their focus from the tours is to see what pretty photos you can get in the area, and then there's kind of a museumification of Tibetan culture in that process as well, and also the transformation of the environment in order to fit pictures, which isn't so cool. they're building a series of dams to make reflections better in one place I visited, and there's also monoculture plantations in order to get autumn leaves to look prettier and things like that. So there's a kind of a transformation of the region into plateaus, and there's also this into pretty pictures, and there's also a beginning to be an emphasis on, which is actually the thing that worked. Well, second thing that worries me, it's not worrying me the most, they both worry me, is this idea of inviting mass tourism to come and stay in kind of RV parks and big hotels and play golf.
What are RV parks?
You know, the big vans that they have in America, where you sleep in the back. I don't know, camper vans,
yeah.
Big camper van parks. They call them RV park. That's, yeah. Anyway, in Chinese, it's RV. So they're all over the place as well. And this means that you're getting a certain type of tourist that isn't kind of is not prepared to deal with hardship and respond to the environment. It's not very eco-tourism, which is not great anyway, but maybe better than golf courses, and individual people driving up there.
Is it still seen as a frontier from the viewpoint of a borderland that is also permeable in a way that threatens the identity and integrity of the Chinese state?
It's still seen as a borderland in some way that's kind of dangerous because of the altitude and so on, but then that makes it exciting. And also what you get is development happening in the lower altitudes. So the eastern part of the plateau around where the Yalantampal Gorge is about 1,000 metres lower than Lhasa, and the west is even higher. So you don't get that much development in the west. But in the eastern areas where it's lower, that's where all the golf courses and the helicopters that fly in are, and the dams making nice reflections, and the yachts on sacred lakes and stuff, yacht terminuses on sacred lakes. And also there's places where I went one year and there's a village, and I've been back and there's a town of a million people. So it's incredibly fast development.
Amwesha, how does it look from the other side, if I can put it like that?
Yeah, so I would also add that discussing the Himalayas from a very, also from an IR and political perspective would have to include Pakistan in it. So it would have to be this triangular India, Pakistan, China as the main players, and then would come in Nepal and Bhutan, so the other smaller states. And how it has been working is that, so I work on the foothills. I'm a foothills person, so foothills of the Himalayas. So I see the Bhutanese hills where I do my work. So on the Indian side, and in the from the Pakistan, what is happening? So most of you, I think, are aware of the Kashmir issue and what is going on in Kashmir, and about recently India took off this special status, revoked the special status for Kashmir, and instead we write about it in the brief, and that they have turned Jammu and Kashmir into two different union territories along with Ladakh. And till today, it has been about now 70 days, Kashmir is under lockdown. And Pakistan has been taking this to all the other countries and has been asking for, to put pressure on India, even went to the UN, that, but India has said that this is our personal issue. Now, recently, it has always been seen that China has supported, in terms of foreign policy, Pakistan. But recently, just last week, Xi Jinping visited India, and he said that Kashmir should continue to remain an internal issue for India, and that, Pakistan should not be interfering in it. So from the Indian side, the other thing that goes on is appeasing the smaller hill state. So India and Bhutan share this friendship treaty, and that's how they're constantly building dams on the rivers that are coming down from the Himalayas. And that's how, there's a dam building competition happening between India and China. And India often uses, its leverage with Bhutan to be constructing these dams. So this is sort of a power play going on amongst these different nations and trying to appease or work towards work with the other smaller nations, and that's how India has been doing. And of course, Siachen Glacier, which I spoke about before, it's like the highest militarized place in the world, and that is Indian military. And it's surprising that, there have been some calls by environmentalists to turn this into a peace park and using these soldiers for environmental conservation. But each time there is a talk, there are then relations dampened between India and Pakistan or India and China, and then the talks fail and there has not been a peace park yet. So it has been like, and this is where I think the conflict in the Himalaya part comes through, both transgovernmental conflict between nations, but also different conflict between different ethnic groups in that region.
Okay, that's a good segue to bring in Alex on this, and particularly to maybe to inject a bit more of your historical background, which you cover in the brief.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So we talk about in the brief about the process of decolonization in India and China and by extension Pakistan. And there was an idea going around at that time that the Himalaya is the quote unquote natural border between India and China, that it's this great physical barrier that separates these two enormous plains-based states. And that really, that idea of the Himalaya as a natural border between these places really feeds into a lot of the things that we're seeing today. So someone that we cite in the brief is Bernice Goyo-Rashad, who has written a book called Shadow States, and she argues that India and China were shadowing one another in the Himalaya, Each state could imagine the Himalayan region as part of its own territory, but equally it could be imagined as part of the other's territory. So this metaphor of a shadow, she's actually referring to Westminster parliamentary systems of a shadow government. So there's this idea that either of these states could be the governor of a particular territory, and this shapes the way that they were imagining the region. And they did, as you mentioned, they fought a border war in 1962, and that leads to the sense of the area of the region and the borders as a site of nationalist sacrifice, and that's another thing that feeds into tourism.
Great. Anwesh, I want to turn back to your work on smaller states, because I think that's an interesting counterpoint to the big giants squaring off against one another from a great power mindset. India on one side, China, you were quite right to bring Pakistan into the equation, but I want to go down another layer, maybe look at Bhutan, Nepal as well, which we haven't spoken about so far yet. Are they any better at handling the transboundary challenges in governance that are flagged by all of the authors in the brief?
Yeah, so India and Bhutan actually is quite interesting, because India and Bhutan have a friendship treaty And there is like free passage between India and Bhutan, the borders where I worked. And it is actually a very friendly border. And I worked on this something called an irrigation channel from rivers that flow down from Bhutan into India. And the people can actually access that river freely. So you can see like how if you have a friendly border, then at a subnational level, it can actually help with the conflict that are at a, you know, a very macro level. So in that sense, India and Bhutan have been sharing very cordial relationship. But having said that, it does not then negate the fact that India and Bhutan are also constructing hydropower dams upstream, which then have the ability to flood the downstream areas. So as you know, there was this issue where China for some time was not sharing its water release data with India, but it shared it with Bangladesh, which was further downstream. And that then was a problem. But then we were told by someone that even after China shared its water release data with India, India didn't do anything with the data. So they just made it into a political issue.
They paid for it.
So in that sense, I think the smaller states, I think they are trying to somewhere find a footage because, you know, India and China are the big players in the region. And with Bhutan and Nepal, somehow India always... So with Nepal, for example, there was this recent earthquake in Nepal, right? The major massive earthquake. Now, as soon as the earthquake happened, India sent in its disaster management authority in there, all the aid possible, as if there was a takeover of Nepal by India. And finally, the Nepali government had to say, like, listen, we don't need you here. Like, you know, we can manage our crisis. So India has always been a big brother in that region. And there's been this competition with, you know, historically with Pakistan. And now, of course, there's the growth competition with China. So that's how, you know, like all of them try to control the smaller states. So India more so with Nepal and Bhutan and China more so with Pakistan.
And then Nepal.
And now Nepal. Yes, yeah, so he just visited, she just visited Nepal after, it's the first visit in decades. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I saw there was a report just last week, I think, talking about a new train project that will potentially take a high-speed train all the way down to the southern southern border.
And people who work in South Asia say it's never going to happen. And because I work in China, I say, of course it is. The stuff I've seen in across China, the trains and the... Phew! and the dams and so on.
And Wesha, maybe I've not visited, but again, one of the other striking images that sort of leaps to mind when you think of the Himalaya are those long queues of mountaineers trying to get to the top of Mount Everest. Quite surreal. Does tourism and the associated money that it brings... Is that a net hindrance or a net help to the situation?
I mean, I don't know who this tourism money... Like, so in I work in a national park, and it's in the state of Assam, the Kaziranga National Park. And that park has been now really closed off, and there's a lot of money that comes for rhino conservation to that park from all over the world. But if you look at the revenue that tourism generates for that park, is not as much. So it is mostly this international funding that comes in for the conservation of these places, which is better for the state. But tourism has always been problematic. And I think a few days ago, there was this case where an Indian tourist went to Bhutan and walked up a stupa. And he was just standing on top of a religious shrine. So there is like tourism going on there, but it is not sensitive or sensible tourism. And it's the same issue with the military. So there's also been this, I mean, I'm slightly going off topic, but there has been, it's been said that the American military are the highest polluters and emitters in the world. And the army does pollute and, you know, it's really problematic, the amount of emission and waste that these armed forces create. And so what we have in India now is something called the Ecological Task Force, which is made out of the retired armed forces people, and their work is to go into areas and work on nature conservation, and it is working quite well. And that's why I was thinking, if the army, as Ruth's first point, the army and the tourism coming together, and it can actually work towards conservation of biodiversity.
Well, Ruth, Tell us more about some of the success stories in the region, particularly focusing on local knowledge. How can this be encouraged and strengthened in managing the problems of the Himalaya?
There's kind of this weird dichotomy that you have with a lot of people saying, because I'm from the region, therefore I'm a good ecologist or I'm a good conservationist. And I'm not sure I agree with that. But there is a basic principle that if you have generations of people living in a place and they don't die, right, if they survive, it means they've figured out a way to manage the environment, right? So there's like a basic relationship between the continuation of people living in one place and some kind of equilibrium with the environment. I mean, sometimes the lapse is really long and you can have people live in an environment for 2,000 years and then there's like a what they call an extinction debt and then everything collapses and they have to move. But most of the time you end up, if you have a community living in a place for a long time, they've figured out a way not to trash it. That's the same. It's true in Australia. It's true in the Himalaya. So I think what you have, and so many things that I see in the Himalaya, I think resonate with Australia. There is people coming in from the outside, not listening to the people who live in the region, who figured out how to balance the local ecology and live within their means. And they've brought in other ideas and said, oh, you're doing it wrong and you need to do it this way. And then by telling them to change everything they're doing, then the ecological systems collapse and it's a big mess, right? But you do have some systems where eventually, after completely trashing a place, then you've had a return to encouragement of traditional practices. So I'd say Northern Sikkim is one example of this. They've had some projects in Northern Sikkim. The locals got together and banned single-use plastic and even took that idea to the army and told them they weren't allowed to do it.
Can you tell us a bit about Sikkim's status?
Okay, Sikkim. Sikkim is a state in northern India that was an independent kingdom until the mid-1970s. And then because of ethnic tensions within in the kingdom and because of threats from China, they invited the Indian army in and decided to become part of India. It had traditional people living in that area for thousands of years, and then in the 1600s, some Tibetan groups migrated down and managed to convince the locals that they should be the ruling family, which is good for them. And then in the 1800s, their ruling families did a lot of deals with the British and Nepali business people, and a lot of Nepali people migrated in. So now you kind of get these ethnic tensions between the indigenous people, the Bhutia who came down from Tibet, and the Nepali, which are the majority population. A lot of the environmental practices in the region get caught up in ethnic policies and deals between the different groups. Northern Sikkim, however, is kind of closed off. It's basically on the Tibetan plateau. There's a lot of army up there, and it's a very sensitive area, so they can say don't come up here even to tourists and so on. And they did get to the stage where they were trashing the environment up there, and there was a lot of complaints from locals who couldn't herd their animals, and someone ate the last Lhasa Apso dog. So that everyone went, what? You can't eat our dogs? So now they've been doing all of these programs to reintroduce native animals and to balance the ecology. They've trained a lot of the army living up there not to trash the glaciers as they are in Siachen, and from all reports, there's a lot of encouraging signs in regeneration in the area.
That's good. I mentioned Sikkim because I'm particularly proud that the La Trobe Asia Brief will in fact have a Himalayan launch, following a launch in Delhi next month. Anwesha, turning now to away from states to other sort of international governance organisations and the role that they play. Ruth has already mentioned one at the top, but can you just say a little bit more about what they're doing to aid the situation?
Well, Isimot is the, I think it's the one of a kind, the only trans-governmental NGO. And that, they're registered as an NGO?
I don't think they are.
It's an intergovernmental
organization from India. They're situated in Nepal, in Kathmandu.
Okay, it's intergovernmental then.
It's intergovernmental with representations from India.
But scientific intergovernmental and development intergovernmental as opposed to border intergovernmental.
I think they mostly have ecologists and natural scientists as opposed to social scientists. So they do basically climate management, climate crisis, so dealing with climate change and also looking at maybe they work on some livelihood projects of the communities. And they work very closely with, I think, other NGOs and universities in the region to implement some of their programs. But then there's WWF, which also works all over the region on issues of biodiversity. I think Oxfam does. Oxfam has now this transboundary river project, which was going on in one of my field areas, where they're looking at, you know, this. They're trying to now work it out better between India and Bhutan to manage. So management of river systems by local people as opposed to state managing river systems. So they're now trying to push more towards local governance of resources and management of river water systems. So I think these NGOs can actually, more than NGOs, I think CBOs, community-based organizations, can play a very good role. There was this some problem conflict I read about river water sharing between India and Nepal, and then the headmen of the villages actually came together and they said, fine, we don't care about the states anymore. So the village had meetings with each other and came up with their policy on how best to share the water. To give you an example, so as I mentioned that on Bhutan, upstream Bhutan, if there is heavy rain, there is a chance of having flash floods on lower riparian areas. Now, each time there is something going on in the upstream, they have to inform the people downstream. Now, the technical way of doing this would be that where it is happening in Bhutan, they tell Thimphu. Thimphu then contacts New Delhi. New Delhi then goes to the regional government in Assam. And then they go to the village, which would be affected. But instead, what they have done now is that direct WhatsApp messaging. And these WhatsApp messaging systems are working way better than these sort of trans-government and channels. And this actually reinforces the important role that local communities can play along with NGOs. So this is now being done through NGOs. So there are these officers in the Bhutanese government who text the NGO in a small state, in a small area, and they then directly tell the people who they are working with. And these systems are actually informal subnational systems are working.
Alex, one for you. What role can the international community play? What other conservation models might be relevant to the Himalaya?
So on the first part of the question, the international community, all the states in the region have pretty strong histories of resisting and getting irritated by being what to do by being told by other actors, by the international community. So India, for example, does not like it when it's told what to do by the US, or when Donald Trump said a couple of weeks ago that he was going to help mediate the Kashmir issue with Pakistan, and India just had no idea. No, we want the opposite of that. We want you to leave that alone. And this is done largely for extremely justifiable reasons, that when you think about the history of colonization of the region in India, China, Nepal, and Nepal says that it was never colonized, but it was still very much influenced by that colonial history, even if it wasn't ruled directly. And so all of the states in the region are quite jealously guarding their sovereignty, and that's for quite justifiable reasons. So the main thing that the international community can do is to actually deal with climate change. It's to curb its emissions. We are all responsible for the emissions which are causing one of the broad overarching problems that we talk about in the brief that are threatening the region. So the international community, the UN, all these international government organizations, they shouldn't tell India, China, Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan what to do. They should deal with climate change and curb their emissions. And there are mechanisms in place to do this, but this doesn't, people don't, states don't seem to be following them particularly well. So there's this concept of common but differentiated responsibility, which by which the West has admitted that it has more responsibility for climate change, but we all have a common need to deal with it.
Something that we try and emphasise with the La Trobe Asia briefs is that we don't just give our authors free licence to talk only about the problems, they also have to suggest a few solutions as well. So there are some policy recommendations in there, and you made me jump ahead, Alex, with your comments about what the international community can do, because I think there's another clear point in one of those recommendations, which is around funding. Do you want to say a bit more about how you envisage that? And Ruth and Wesher, if you want to chime
we
in.
We argue broadly that there needs, this requires money to fix this problem, and that that should be, that burden should be shared by everyone, not just by the states in the region. Another issue with the funding is the way that large dams are funded. So the UN currently funds large dam projects in the Himalaya under its sort of clean development fund. We argue that that is a poor choice for clean energy and clean development when you think that this is an earthquake zone, that these dams are being built on either side of contested borders and they have significant effects downstream, that this needs to be done in a much more environmentally careful and sustainable way. And the UN currently is pumping money into these dam projects rather than looking at alternatives.
So the rivers are being, they're dredging sand from the rivers to build the to use in the concrete of the dams. These are very difficult river systems to maintain, and the dams block off water flows between between the different systems, so that you get dry. It's a really fragile ecosystem. So if you stop water flowing to somewhere, the groundwater depletes, and you get drought really easy. And then in other places, you get soaking. There are other things that you could do, like micro hydro projects and everything that would provide electricity to local areas. But instead, there's this idea of extracting energy from these from the hydro potential of the area. So if you go there, you see massive dams. And my favourite one was a massive dam that was next to a concrete factory that was built in the basin of the river and was dredging sand from the river and making concrete there. And 10% of global emissions come from concrete production. And then behind it, from the dredged sand and the concrete factory, was a big sign saying low carbon clean energy on the dam. Nice. So there's clearly problems with that. But there's a there are things that can be done in other ways. I mean, tweaking that, you know, it doesn't. And also the other thing with the dams is not only are they an earthquake zone, but the climate change is happening at 2 times the global average at least. So the water sources for these regions are going to either dry up or they're going to come down in floods. So if you had a combination of a flood and an earthquake, then that's not good in these regions. Yeah.
Why is it happening twice there? Is that altitude?
Oh, okay. That's my other bugbear. But I was trying to stay calm. One of the other main reasons that it's happening at twice global rates is because there's 2 types of pollution happening. And Alex was talking about the carbon dioxide that we're all contributing to the global environment. There's also another form of carbon pollution that affects the Himalaya particularly, that is particularly associated with developing countries as opposed to developed countries, and that's called black carbon, which you may know better as soot. So if you burn really refined fuel, it just transforms from refined fuel into carbon dioxide. But if you burn unrefined fuel like wood or dung is the main one, or coal, even like unprocessed coal, it produces soot, like black carbon as well as carbon dioxide. And then because of the way the monsoons work, any black carbon or any soot that's produced in the Indian or Chinese basins at the bottom of the Himalayan region gets sucked up and dumped on the ice. And that basically means like putting a black blanket on top of a white car, which I'm from Queensland, so I know is a bad idea, right? Because everything just heats up within the car, and white reflects white reflects the light back. But if there's black on top of it, it just sucks the heat into it. And this is one of the main drivers for accelerated climate change in the region.
To go back to your question about what can the international community do, I sort of started off by suggesting that, well, they need to back off to some extent and deal with some of their own issues. But the other thing that we take as a model for dealing with these problems is the Arctic Council and Antarctic Governance Treaty systems. So the other two poles of the world, the Himalayas often referred to as the third pole when we think about the third largest ice pack in the world, is to build governance organisations that that are in some way modelled or draw ideas from these other environmentally crucial cold regions of what's known as the cryosphere. So that means governance organisations that take into account local voices. So this means a slight sort of decentralisation of governance particularly across the ice pack and the abode of snows, the cold places in Asia. And then also this means incorporating scientific voices into the governance of the region as well. So you have local peoples and scientists incorporated into governance architecture. At the moment, we quite often think of the Himalaya as a region that is just controlled by states. But a lot of the examples we've talked about have been about local peoples, indigenous knowledge, subnational actors like the state of Sikkim incorporating protocols, being important actors in broader governance of an international region. And so we urge that these examples be built upon and that scientific and local voices be incorporated into the way that the region is governed. And that means building a greater sense of regional identity as well.
Thanks. And Wesha, what recommendation would you like to highlight from the brief?
Well, I mean, this is not really in the brief, but it does come through, is the climate diplomacy. Because India and China in the last Durban conference, they actually went away saying that, oh, we both are going to be leaders. And India said, oh, I'm going to be the leader in controlling these emissions. And 1 year later, the whole thing collapsed. Because the problem is you have all these climate treaties, but none of these are binding upon the states to implement them. And if you cannot make these binding in some way, this is not going to work. So the other thing that these states, especially, you know, vulnerable regions like the Himalayas, have to recognize is that, yes, you have your geopolitical tension, but the environment has to come somewhere on top of that, because it has to be given a priority. And climate diplomacy, as a form of diplomacy amongst these nations, by somewhere sidelining their political issues, can actually go a long way in addressing or mitigating climate change. And that is something I think is very important for the states to take into consideration. I mean, Narendra Modi, the prime minister, was given this UN's highest environment leadership award. But then they did this river water or a water conference in Bangalore, and they talked about water as water only being in India. They just don't want to even talk about transborder, but water flows. And then the prime minister, so there is a dam dispute between India and Bangladesh, the Farakka dam, because India doesn't want to release water, and because it thinks because of that, because, you know, there's a dispute between, you know, this sharing of water in that dam. And then the prime minister of Bangladesh visited India, and they talked about the Farakka dam water release thing, but nothing came out of it. But she wrote an article saying friendship is like flowing water. So, you know, so these are very important things that has to be taken into account, and somewhere the states have to then, you know, take this climate diplomacy at some level to make things work.
So there's a lot of obviously very tricky, wicked problems, and no easy solution to many of them. The question I guess I have, just to kick that the discussion phase off, is it too late? If all your recommendations were implemented tomorrow, do you think that this would turn it around? Or just quick thoughts from each of the panelists, and then we'll go over to the floor. Maybe starting with you, Ruth.
If there's life, there's hope.
Pithy and short. I like it. Alex?
I'm not particularly hopeful. But if all of the recommendations were implemented tomorrow, we would still have major issues, but we would be on the way to fixing things.
And Russia?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't completely, you know, we have done the damage and it's not irreversible, but we can be in remission.
All right. So Alex and Wesha, Ruth, and your absent co-authors, I wish you all the best for your upcoming Indian and especially the Sikkim launch, which I think has an unmistakable ring about it. Please do, if you haven't already, pick up a copy of the brief. If you're interested, there is also an associated podcast with Alex and Ruth, which contains my favourite line, because we have a podcast titled Asia Rising, and Ruth says that this literally is where Asia is rising. The Himalaya continues to grow as a result of the millions-year-old collision between India and the rest of the Asian continent. As a result of that, we do at least have still some ice to be thankful for. Thank you also to you in the audience for coming today and for your questions and interest in La Trobe Asia and in the Himalaya. And we hope to see you at future events. Please just join me in thanking the authors.